Okay, well, I will start to ping people in. Jason, maybe you want to recap what we talked about last time and tell us what's on your mind today.
All right, so last week I talked about why I thought meritocracy was a valid concept, not an anti-concept, and I went through the stages of explaining Rand's theory of egalitarianism and showing how a truly meritocratic society, in the moral sense, not in the p sense that people have always thought of meritocracy as a political society in which a set of political elites are allocated favors and powers are dispensed among. I think Rand had this notion in her letter titled, and on her article titled "An Untitled Letter" in her Ayn Rand letters. And so I went through the various stages of why we needed America, why meritocracy was very, very important in a culture of mediocrity and that was bankrupt. And what I'd like to do today is to show that in some sense, if we're going to have a proper meritocratic society in the moral sense, that the logical concomitant of that is going to be a society with a select number or any number of elites, and that elitism, in the way that I'm taking it from both the encyclopedia and from the dictionary, in the moral sense, is a proper concomitant of a meritocratic society. So, just to recap a little bit, you know, Rand had railed against egalitarianism, as stating that it's really the leveling down of mankind to the common denominator of its least competent members because of two primary premises behind egalitarianism. It defied the law of causality by demanding equal results from unequal causes, and it also demanded equal rewards from or for unequal performance. And throughout her life, it was her view, I think I mentioned it yesterday, in Richard's talk, it was basically Rand's view that the culture was pretty bankrupt. She mentioned this in her talk on our cultural value deprivation and a subsequent article that was published, I think, in The Voice of Reason. And in her article at the Ford Hall Forum on a cultural update, she said the culture was not just militantly bankrupt, it was routinely bankrupt. And I suppose by that she gave reasons that the dominant philosophy or the dominant cultural ethos was one that presented the individual man as depraved, that there was an absence or a paucity of unifying principles, integrated philosophic principles around which we could tie our values. The rising tide of collectivism and the assault against reason, irrationality. So it was a chronic and all-pervasive state. And I would add that, personally, looking at the culture, that our culture is not just militantly bankrupt, it's also routinely vulgar, coarse, unrefined in almost every aesthetic sphere of life. It's unspeakably garish and ugly. And even without, I would say, the comedic dignity of even camp, schlock, or shtick, kitsch, rather, to sort of buffer it. So I'm not in agreement with William A. Henry III's defense of elitism in all of its guises, but he did, because one of the reasons I am not, is because he never gives a proper defense of elitism. He just sort of takes it for granted. But he did write that he realized that the wrath directed at elitism had less to do with money than with populist egalitarian scorn for the very kinds of intellectual distinctions that he holds most dear: respect, deference towards leadership and position, esteem for accomplishment, especially when achieved through long labor and rigorous education, heritage, particularly in history, philosophy, and culture, commitment to rationalism and scientific investigation, And importantly, upholding of objective standards, most important, the willingness to assert unyieldingly that one idea or contribution or attainment is better than another. So the definition of elitism that I'm working with is the idea that individuals who form an elite are a select group of people perceived as having intrinsic or cultivated, really cultivated quality, high intellect, wealth, power, notability, special skills, and experience, and are more likely people who are elites in that moral sense, because they've cultivated, they've honed their sensibilities, are more likely to be constructive to society as a whole. And I'll say a bit more about why I'm using this appeal to society, because I think that is more conducive to the practice of individualism. But they're more constructive to society as a whole, and therefore deserve influence and authority, greater influence and authority than others, in governing, in having their sensibilities, their norms, their mores, govern society. So the form of elitism I'm really defending is the brand that distinguishes people based on merit, as I talked about last week, achievements, success, moral status. Those who exhibit a very, very long track record of competence in a very demanding field, who show extensive discipline, extensive history of dedication and effort in some service, in service to some specific field, and who have a high degree of accomplishment, training, or wisdom in a given field. Now, I would say that an ostensive definition of an elite society would be Galt's Gulch in Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, because there you have a set of specialized, highly rational people with specialized honed sensibilities that are superior to other people. So one of the things I do like about In Defense of Elitism by William Henry, and I've relied almost very little on this book to defend my sense of elitism, but because I think it's just very philosophically inconsistent. But he does say that the idea behind egalitarianism, of which elitism is an antidote, is the belief that a truly just society would automatically produce equal success results across the lines of race, class, and gender, and that the common man is almost always right. And that I would add the idea that all cultures are equal. This is something I'm going to defend here, that we can speak of elite cultures, elite civilizations, really, I'm talking about, as much as we can speak about elite cultures. And so I would say that I am defending a version of elitism when it comes to civilizations, and I'm defending a version of elitism when it comes to individuals. So it is a common, I would say, canard among the educated cognoscenti that all cultures are equal. And we can certainly look out at the world and see that some cultures are abysmally inferior and regressive based on their comprehensive philosophy and fundamental beliefs, or lack thereof, that guide or fail to protect the inalienable rights of citizens. So one can say that, all persons, I think that all persons are endowed with equal intrinsic moral worth as human beings, which they could corrupt by committing morally egregious acts. But as individuals, they're possessed of inviolable moral worth, which cultures are not, because cultures are not indivisible wholes. But I would say the United States, as a civilization, it's not a culture, it's a civilization, is not perfect, but as a rights-bearing culture in which the inalienability of rights are observed, a country in which civil liberties such as freedom of speech is still upheld, freedom of conscience and freedom of religious association, is vastly superior to barbaric and primitive cultures that have yet to discover the individual and his or her inviolate dignity. So America, the United States, is a republic devoted to the inalienability of those rights that are conducive to human flourishing and surviving. And through its Constitution, Bill of Rights, it is the first political system to discover the direct correlation between the rational nature of man, the individual, as an individual, and the exact political milieu in which that nature has to properly live and function. So we look at countries like Sudan, Nigeria, Mauritania, Libya, Algeria, all countries which still practice and tolerate chattel slavery by Arabs and black Muslims against other Christians and Muslims. And they're not the political or moral equals to the United States of America, Israel, Great Britain, and even France. And those countries are vastly superior to Saudi Arabia, Iran, North Korea, Gaza, if that piece of plot of land even qualifies as a culture, which do not permit religious reciprocity. And I would say that the cannibalistic anti-civilization of the Aztecs could never and would never be the cultural equal of any civilized and free society anywhere in the world today. So cultures that permit freedom of association, respect the equality of all citizens and legal residents before the law, that uphold certain unassailable moral axioms like equality of all persons before the law, that allow individuals to cultivate their unique life plans, I would classify as elite cultures. And I think it's a mark of sheer what I would call cognitive malarkey to claim that all cultures are equal. So just as some cultures are technologically more advanced than others, so some are politically more distinguished in their record on individual rights and the protection of private property and personal liberty. So
may I raise my hand for a question, please?
Not yet. I'm not finished. Just let me finish because I don't want to, I'm on a trajectory here and I don't want to lose my train of thought. So just hold off until we get to the question and answer period. So in a world where, for example, the distinction between high culture and low culture has not just been blurred, but obliterated, how do we regain an aristocracy or a refinement, qualitatively speaking, of sensibilities and standards when we have, as is spreading through the K-12 public school system, where honors programs are being abolished on the premise that they are discriminative against slow learners, right? Where every country that is a political or economic sinkhole that drags down the regional value, economic, politically, etc., in which it is ensconced, is hailed as the equal of the United States, how do we respond? And so just as we must contend, I think, with the fact that there are social ballasts in every society, so we must accept that there are countries that are ecological, political ballasts. So an elite cadre of what I would call a united union of moral nations, which I would include the United States of America, England, France, Israel, stand as an antidote and inoculant against the ravages of value deprivation from which individuals of such nations suffer, and in which by default they infect a society with their anti-values. So I think what we actually need is a sort of stratification of refined talents, a stratification of refined sensibilities that can actually elevate human beings from the wretchedness and the drudgery of their lives, and offer an aspirational ideal of what constitutes a truly elite individual and an elite society, a society governed by a principle of elitism. So when we have universities that are offering endowed chairs in hip hop and rap studies, a musical genre that is filled with expletives, a musical genre that is devoted exclusively to promoting thug and gang culture as a prescriptive idea, where sexual acts are form both the pathos, and the only form of prosody in the genre, I think there's no lower place to sink in terms of aesthetic or moral depravity. And when we have a society that is suffused through by means of the university with diversity, equity, and inclusion demands, which I spoke about last week as just lowering standards, and we have the woke mob, which and their unbridled feelings that supersede those who are advocates of reason, we do need, I think, an elite vanguard of social, aesthetic, and moral elites as cultural, I would call them aristocrats, to do the following: to function as competitors in the age of nihilism and mediocrity that I think we're living in, to re-socialize the sensibilities of lesser people who subject us to their weak and perverse moral agendas and their anti-value agendas, to raise the civilizational value of our culture so that individualism can thrive. Because I think when mediocrity and substandards are backed by law, like the DEI initiatives, and entrenched institutional norms, it is only a sort of implacable and intransigent, a set of implacable and transcendent values of a rational elite of deliberate value makers codified into something of a robust counterculture that can stop the conveyor belt of villainy, mediocrity, and the subnormal and the kind of swamp of gutter trivia that constitute modern culture from taking root. And I would say that objectivists are an elite vanguard of intellectual activists and theorists, but activists as practitioners of being value creators in the world. And actually, cultural relativists, the anti-reason advocates, the egalitarian altruists, and those lacking any objective criteria to measure matters of taste, those who ratify aesthetic forms of life by means of a sort of crude naturalistic mentality, are properly excluded from this domain. So the devotion to excellence in all spheres of life is not uniquely objectivist, is not a uniquely objectivist characteristic, I should say, but one can't be a proper objectivist without aspiring to moral excellence and moral ambition, the precondition of which is an absolute and tenacious commitment to reason and a rejection of any kind of unity that coalesces around the non-exceptional. So an explicit rejection of the common, the ordinary, the average is what is embodied in an elitist principle. And it is creative nations and creative peoples, the minority stock, that have created history. So those who wish, I think, to elevate their sophomoric high school opinions to the level of human knowledge have a lot of social currency today. And that ethos certainly governs the academy and the educational premise of the K through 12 education. So the prism, I think, of moral elitism in wrapping up, governed by a sort of scrupulous commitment to reason, is a buffer against the village idiocy, which is a logical concomitant of this ruling ethos. Not everyone can get let into the future, as is the naive promise of liberalism and hyperdemocracy. And social ballast, that is, unthinking human beings who are responsible for the total malarchy I've described, have already ejected themselves from the domain of what I would call rational human intercourse. So I think Rand was right. The jungles are not approaching the cities. The cities have become our jungles, and the barbarians are not at the gates. They are inside the city jungles. And their voices result in a radical demoralization of humanity. And it is time, in the name of, I think, José Ortega-Gasset, who's very close in many respects to Rand's thinking, would say that it's time for a moral, aesthetic, and cultural elites, for those elites to push back and abort their screams and their snarls and their uncouth demands in the spirit of Ayn Rand, in the name of the luminous potential of the greatest minority on earth, which is the individual. And I think I'll stop there. I have much more, but I'll stop there.
Thank you. Jason, could I respond?
No, we're going to go in order, sir. So I'll call on you when we're ready. We are delighted to have our founder, David Kelly, founder of the Atlas Society, here with us. David, did you want to weigh in on what Jason just shared? David, you'd have to unmute yourself.
There are so many things in Jason's presentation that I could pick up on, and but at the same time, I missed the first segment of this. So let me just add, Jason, I'll ask you one question, and then I'm going to leave the floor open to others. One of the things that's puzzled me over the years is that in education, is that the systems in France and in Europe and in England previously anyway, were very hierarchical. That is, they looked for talent, they promoted talent, they had no embarrassment about admitting only the best best performing, best talented students to their higher educational things, even than America was, even though they are in its culturally more collectivist, more state oriented than America is. And that's kind of a paradox. And do you think my observation is correct? And if so, do you have any thoughts about it?
I do think your observation is correct, David. And I just think it's one of the unique paradoxes of the educational systems in, it's not just France and England, and it's also the Netherlands and Sweden and in Finland. They have very, very high standards while having, you know, this kind of collectivist welfare state. My sense is, having lived in Germany for a year and having taught in Hungary for 6 months and lectured, you know, throughout Europe, is that there is, going back to the idea of José Ortega Gasset's idea of what the university is supposed to do, he had, I think, four mission statements of the university. One was the teaching of the learned professions. I'm taking this from his book on the idea of the university, the fostering of scientific research, the training for political leadership. And the fourth one for Gasset was the creation of cultured persons with the ability to make intellectual interpretations of the world. So I think going back to the most archaic and the most primitive idea of the university as it originated in Western Europe, there were pristine standards of excellence that were fixed to both the philosophic idea of a university and the pedagogical means by which knowledge was dispensed, that was just constitutive of the idea of a university itself, and that stood at odds with of course the collectivist premises that ruled society. So I think these are just two paradoxes that we have to reckon with, that the idea of the university as it originated in Europe had these built-in missions that were devoted to cultivating excellence, going back to Aristotle's Paideia and Plato's school. We see it when I'm more interested in Aristotle's Paideia, the cultivation of virtue through habituation, but not just habituation, through a rational understanding eventually of why one is doing what one is doing. So I do think your observation is right. I'm not an anthropologist. I don't have an explanation for why the paradox exists, except I can only point to the mission and the philosophic idea of a university as it originated in Europe was intrinsically cultivated to something like elitism, the creation of cultured persons with an ability to make intellectual interpretations of the world. And out of that arose, of course, the scientific method, where one has to be precise and rigorous in one's thinking in order to have given birth to something like modern science as we know it today.
All right. Thanks. And folks, I wanted to also just let you know, in addition to being a senior scholar at the Atlas Society, Professor Jason Hill teaches philosophy at DePaul University, and he's the author of several books. And I will be cycling those in and out of the PIN section of the site. If you're enjoying this conversation, please go ahead and share it on Clubhouse and share it on your social media platforms. Scott.
Thank you. Good topic. I just had a quick comment. I think I understand what you're talking about with elites and, you know, kind of that cultural refinement that we need. But I just think it's important to make a distinction between that and the kind of corrupt elites running all of these kind of woke institutions these days. And that's what a lot of people are bristling at when they hear about elitism. Or, you know, I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Well, that's why I said the form of elitism that I'm defending is a kind of moral elitism. And I spent a lot of time talking about the kind of refinement of sensibilities, refinement of a skill set that one can leverage in the world in a efficacious manner that yield certain results that are beneficial to human survival, to the well-being of the individual. There isn't anything that those parasitic, contemptuous political elites that call themselves politicians are doing. They have no skill set. They have no set of refined sensibilities. They have, I mean, one of Gassette's missions of the university was, I'm not sure I agree with this, but was training the individual for political leadership. This goes against the idea of what the founding fathers had for America, where the ordinary common man could aspire to the presidency. So yeah, I think that distinction has to be made. I did make it, and I don't even think that those people should be called political elites. I think they should be, they're a tribe. They're a cauldron of mediocrities and display none of the characteristics that we would associate with elites in the proper sense of the term. I think it's just a colloquial understanding that's. And it's a misconception of the understanding of what elitism really is all about that people like Tucker Carlson and people usually on the right, conservatives, bandy about to describe those people in Washington.
I was a couple minutes late.
Okay.
Okay, US of A, you're on.
Thank you. I would just like to say that as a young child, I was brought up as an objectivist. Both of my parents were adherents of Ayn Rand, and I remember reading the Atlas Shrugged and the Fountainhead very from a very early age, and the essays, one of which stuck with me was on lifeboat ethics. Do you remember Rand's essay about lifeboat ethics, the ethics of emergencies? Because the reason I ask is because in that essay, she admitted that there was a flaw in the pure selfish act. And I have tried to describe this flaw by posting into the group chat channel and existentialcomics.com comic number 234, which has to do with desert island ethics. That is to say, that imagine that you and 10 other people wash up on the store the shore from a wreck, a shipwreck, and there's one doctor among the 11 people who are on that island, and the doctor has very important skills that are very much in demand, but everybody else has ordinary skills. They can go out and they can spear fish food, they can climb to harvest coconuts. Well, what might ordinarily happen under such a situation with unfettered free trade is that the doctor obtains a natural monopoly based on his advanced skills. And Ayn Rand normally would say that this is the normal course of action that should be encouraged. However, we know from the science of economics that when a monopoly occurs, you get a market failure. And we're seeing that right now because supply chain constrictions have caused inflation. The shock from Russia invading Ukraine caused a huge increase in the cost of oil, and that has caused all kinds of increases in prices in food and medicine and ordinary
So
consumer goods.
I'm going to let Jason, very interesting stuff, but I especially since we have also David Kelly here,
Well,
maybe
I do have one specific question I'd like to ask of Jason.
Okay, ask it, please.
Okay. So meritocracy is important, but it is at eternal odds with egalitarianism. That is to say, if you only promote people based on their merit, then you necessarily demote people who are otherwise on an equal footing. And that can lead to a situation in which you get an elite, an entrenched elite, which might have a tendency towards nepotism. And the nepotism, if allowed to continue, will lead to inbreeding. So what do you think Ayn Rand might suggest to oppose the tendency towards nepotism?
I just don't see a natural connection. Nepotism is the idea that you dispense or you allocate favors, political, economic, or otherwise, to relatives. I don't see any connection between an elite vanguard of people with super talents that Ayn Rand most certainly would defend. I mean, that's what Galt's culture is filled with, and the necessary connection that you would dispense favors to your family members. I think as someone, Rand was totally against the idea of family, really extended family.
Okay, understood.
Let me finish my answer. Let me finish my answer, because you asked it, and I want to answer as thoroughly. I'm a philosopher, and answer as thoroughly as possible. Rand would say that the rational person would give the job or dispense the resource or whatever it is that one is the value that one is allocating to the most qualified person, not to some distant third cousin, not even to one's parents or one's siblings, but one would give it to the person who was most qualified in reason, that reality would be the final arbiter, and that there's no necessary connection, no logical connection between nepotism and a meritocratic society at all. There's no reason that let's say I had a particular talent, or I had a particular skill that I developed, and I started a company. There's nothing illogical or in reality that would suggest I would give it to a mediocre, I would employ a mediocre relative, knowing that that would bring down the value of my business. I would want the sharpest, smartest person, whether he or she's from Harvard or from a small or whatever, or maybe not even college, just the smartest person. There's no logical connection between nepotism and the meritocratic society.
Could I ask you a question relative to history? We have a lot of evidence towards history that people who believe that they have been.
Sorry, we're going to keep moving along.
Excuse me, could I just answer one follow-up question?
We're trying to give everyone a chance.
Chance.
All right, Roger.
Hi, thanks. Jason, my question, I totally agree with you that there are some things that are better than others. It is an objective thing and not, you know, a subjective thing. The problem I always have when trying to make that point is that it seems like I'm just appealing to one set of virtues, such as individualism or private property or something like that, while the other side is appealing to another set of virtues, diversity, equity, inclusion among them. And I've tended to think that you might need a theory of value to be able to, you know, convince the other side. And so the question is, do you think what you presented constitutes a theory of value, or are you comfortable with, as I heard you saying, appealing to a set of virtues? If you juxtapose the other side's positions to this side's, there doesn't seem anything structurally different unless there's a theory that you can pass the contents through. Okay, I'm done.
Well, I don't see a dichotomy or a chasm between the two. I would go back to that fabulous essay by Ayn Rand in The Virtue, the Voice of Reason, called "Who is the Final Authority in Ethics?" which she thought was a nonsensical question. And she said that ultimately, in matters of knowledge, no one is a final authority. Reality is a final arbiter. That human beings, in some sense, nature does not decide. It is the individual who decides in issues of knowledge, that he or she observes that which is. And so I would say to someone that my theory of elitism is based in reality. That is, it's not just based on a personal whim or a personal aesthetic desire. That is, there are standards, there are philosophic meaning tests that I can ostensibly point to that correspond to reality. For example, I mean, I don't like my doctor because he compliments me, or he's a nice person, or I don't, if I were having heart surgery, I wouldn't just like someone because she's beautiful or he's handsome or whatever. I would want that proven, that this person is the most competent person available to me, and make my decisions based on that person's skill set, invoking a sort of elitist principle here that corresponds to reality. So, I think, Roger, I'm not seeing the distinction between a value and a virtue, that the both of them have to go hand in hand, because both of them, in some sense, must correspond to an objective reality. And David, I don't know if you want to jump in here. And
yes, I do, briefly anyway, Jag, if it's okay. First of all, one point I think it's essential to make here is that the previous questioner raised the question of a desert island and the lifeboat situation and Rand's ethics of emergencies. The point of that essay of Rand's is that an ethical system has to deal with the normal context of human life. There are emergencies, and when you're in an emergency, the context that is the foundation of ethics, in particular, the fact that in normal life, the harmony, we have a harmony of interest between people. Someone else's success does not take anything away from me, and vice versa. In a lifeboat situation, there are conflicts of interest, and that's why it's important to get out of them as soon as possible. But that's not a standard for ethics. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, to Roger's question, there is a basis for a value set. The whole objectivist ethics is based on a rational derivation of where the concept of value comes from and what it means in regard to human life. I don't want to run through it. It would be a whole separate lecture, but many lectures. And Jason, you know this as well as I do. But their values are not subjective. Someone else's alternative, other set of values, doesn't mean that it's equally valid. We're not relativists. But values are objective. We can argue about what the objective basis is, but if you start with the assumption that it's relative or that all values are subjective or group based or whatever, you're off the playing field in a sense.
All right, Roger. Hopefully that helps. If not, stick around and we'll come back to you, Jordan. It's great to see you again.
Great to see you. Good to see you, Dr. Jason, as well, and Jennifer and David and all. I may see it sound a bit hypocritical, but this kind of movement of anti-credentialism, which it can be found readily on this platform, I think is kind of interesting. I don't necessarily think of myself as an expert, but diminishing expertise in favor of kind of, as maybe you alluded to, social capital and social currencies. It really, I think, is dangerous. And I wonder if maybe you could speak to that a little more.
Who's doing that? I mean, you mean as something that's being done in our society in general?
It has been done, for example, on this platform where physicians have been disregarded, or their commentary has been dismissed by someone who has access to certain information, and they weaponize the information without consideration of the person with the credential, as an example.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying. Well, I think Rand really addressed this quite properly when she talked about the primacy of consciousness over existence, and going back to the Cartesian method, that is, once you adhere to the idea that there is not an objective reality out there which consciousness discovers, but that consciousness itself creates reality, you let in all kinds of forms of subjectivism, and then you let in cultural and ethical relativism, and you dispense with any kind of independent arbiter that can adjudicate among truth claims, that is reason as the tool and logic as the means of adjudicating among disputing truth claims. So that I think that this kind of ridiculing or downplaying of expertise is a direct result from a culture that increasingly, going back to postmodernism, going back to the critical school, going back to the Frankfurt school, I mean, this could be I might invite one of the other scholars to do a session on this, but the critical theory school, the Frankfurt school, You know, going back to the whole assault on objective reality against reason, attacking on reason, or we have the primacy of consciousness, that consciousness precedes existence, as where it's the opposite, is really the philosophic root, I think, of this notion of dispensing with the credibility of expertise, where expertise is not based on someone's opinions or someone's likes or dislikes, but is rooted in reality. It passes all, just speaking in terms of scientists, there's verifiability, there's verification methods, there's predictability, all the sorts of meaning tests, scientific meaning tests that have to be passed for something to go from a hypothesis to a theory to something that is factual, to stated fact and knowledge. And same thing in philosophy, we have philosophic meaning tests where we just don't spout nonsense. They're subjected to meaning tests. So I do think that it is what Rand would call the primacy of consciousness over existence that has led to radical subjectivism, a radical attack on the... David has done a marvelous job in his talks on this very platform of discussing what constitutes objectivity. I think we're in a culture where people think that objectivity is every single shallow thought or wish or fantasy that they hold. And I want to just be brief here, but that to me seems to be the root of the problem.
Thank you.
Scott, can you give me a hand here? Because looks like what's showing up for me in terms of who's on the stage may not be accurate.
Yeah, I show Rom next.
Yeah, can you hear me?
We can hear you. I can't see you, but do you?
I'm the invisible man. All right. Thank you for the opportunity. Thanks for catching that, Scott. Thrilled to talk to Professor. I've listened to the first episode at least three or four times just to understand some of the words to get the concept. I'm really interested in this. Is like Jennifer said, it's a provoking subject across the world, in my opinion. This whole meritocracy, you know, I'm kind of thinking from a mass man perspective. Meritocracy seems like is like a utopian idea, or, you know, it is not something that's achievable, in my opinion. And second, meritocracy is more like a pseudo meritocracy. And the same goes for even, you know, like with respect to achieving it, even the moral eliteness. Is it even possible? It's an idea that's worth talking about. You know, it might bring about a change in the minds of elites. But I'm wondering, you know, in today's system is developed in a way, I'm thinking, you know, it's by elites. And so it's kind of benefiting the elites more than the mass men. And there is an inherent ego that comes with meritocracy, as well as thinking that, you know, the best ideas are coming from people who are judged by today's standard as who, you know, merit standards. What I'm thinking is that the meritocracy today gives importance to people with good memory and good comprehension. And then they have the drive for, you know, succeeding due to greed. And that's what is, you know, creating this pool of, you know, elite people who seem to come up with commonly attributes that looks down upon the mass men. That's how I perceive it. I may be entirely wrong, but that's how it seems to be coming. And naturally, in the political system, it gives way for both elite as well as mass men. Mass men are more interested in elites than elites, because mass men is coming from the pain point of view, or even from the point of doing some social justice. So when they come up, obviously they will bring about things to kind of de-leveling, the word that Professor Jason used, and sort of, you know, adjust it or balance it. In a way, I'm thinking meritocracy will only give rise to the sectarian politics and then kind of go against the humanity. So my question to you is, isn't like Ayn Rand. I just read this one thing that the five letters at the end of the meritocracy is what is, you know, is what is the right way to look at it, is what Ayn Rand letter mentioned. So I was like thrilled. There are several words that comes with that, and you know, I wanted to think about it a little bit more. But don't you think meritocracy is just an idea that will never be able to be achieved in, you know, with the today's system? And what if the system has changed to say that, okay, hey, greed is not the driving factor here. It is the, you know, like charity is what the driving factor will, what will be the meritocracy system? And, you know, wouldn't it drive a better merit? So in a way, I also agree that the eliteness and meritocracy is important, but today's system is not conducive, and I think the system has to be changed. So I'm kind of putting a lot of things in here. If you have any perspective, let me know. But you know, the main idea is that I'm going with is that meritocracy is not good for humanity as of it is today. And then second is that meritocracy only creates people with, you know, the eliteness that will just highlight ego, greed, and some of these negative attributes than the positive. And mass men are also contributors and the major contributors in today's world to come up, you know, to a state that we are in today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. I would say that, yes, mass men are contributors. We're all contributors, but we're not all equal contributors. So the person who developed the steam engine, the person who developed the plow, the person who developed the typewriter, the person who, you know, will develop the cure for the set of individuals who developed the antiviral drug for HIV, that one doesn't have to die if one has HIV, and the person who, the set of scientists who quickly developed, well, it wasn't quickly, but developed vaccines against COVID, and one doesn't have to die from getting the disease now. Are not equal to, you know, other contributors. So that's the first point I want to make, that yes, we all contribute in some sense, but we don't contribute equally. And in the pyramid of ability and the hierarchy of value creators, not everyone is equal. That's a hard thing for people to stomach. It's just the truth. And I would say that meritocracy, it does exist to the extent that we can ostensibly point to the codification of actions that are the result of a life lived by the principle of reason, excellence, and results that I think Jennifer and Damien used this term last week, working smart, that working, not just working hard, but working smart in a way that produces results that are efficacious and successful vis-a-vis the goals to which they're being put, the hard work is being put in service. So I don't know that meritocracy is a high in the pie, sky in the, you know, dream or utopian fantasy. I think we see smidgets of it in our society to the extent that we can point ostensibly to the codification of actions that are meritorious, that are efficacious, that are the results of excellence, and that are results of refined and well-honed skills and intelligence, right? Let's talk about intelligence here. We're not all equally intelligent. So, you know, mass man, however Jose Ortega Gasset made of him, the common man, however Gasset made of him, and Nietzsche made of such people, individuals, are not all people are possessed of equal intelligence. And the disparity among individuals vis-a-vis their intelligence will produce different results. So if all the mass men sort of went on strike, if not all the mass men went on strike, if a significant number of the mass men went on strike, we wouldn't be in such, just read Atlas Shrugged, we wouldn't be in such dire straits as we would be if the human beings, the individuals of ability, because they're more irreplaceable because of the scarcity of their skill set, which relies on genius or human ability, which is a much more rare commodity than is just brute, raw, physical labor, which everyone possesses. So I would have to say that, third, just to be brief to wrap up here, because we do have other people, greed, I'm very skeptical of this term greed, because I think it's banded about in a way that just speaks to individuals applying their intelligence to the problem of human survival, which is what production is. Reason is it's applied reason to the problem of human survival and reaping the benefits of their applied intelligence and getting as much money. I say as much money as you can get it and get some more while you're growing your mind and applying your values in a tangible form that people will ratify through their purchasing power. So I'm very suspicious of the way that greed is used in the world, because it's just it's what Rand would, I think, call placing a moratorium on the brains. And I'll stop there.
All right. Thank you. Damien, and then Miles.
Hello. Can you hear me? Hello. I know I had trouble last time.
Okay. Yeah, good to have you back.
Thank you. I came in a few minutes late, so I apologize if I missed this. But I'm still having a bit of an issue trying to understand. Maybe I'm misunderstanding the concept here, because it's hard for me to find a reason to even, you know, try to defend, I guess, elitism, because I can't disassociate, I guess, whatever would be the opposite of meritocracy with like slavery, you know, because I guess I look at it as if, you know, I can't consume more than I produce. And if I do that, then I'm taking from someone else. If they're willing to do that for me, that's one thing. But then if I say that they owe that to me, then that's another thing. So I immediately just like associate that with some sort of a slavery claim. So, or a master claim, I don't know what you would call it. But so for me, that, I guess I look at it as, where's, okay, how is it that somebody would want me to make a case for my own freedom? Or for me, why do I have to defend my right to keep the things that I have, you know, produced? And so, and the other thing that I would say with that is that the other mechanism that I guess we have is the price mechanism. Whereas if I produce something, whatever I charge for it and accept for it, that's what I accept for it. So even if I am, you know, providing a surplus to other people, if what I'm doing is more valuable than what I'm charging for it, then so what? I'm satisfied with the income or, you know, the return that I receive. So I don't know if that was the actual question, but that's kind of what my thoughts are.
All right. So I will say maybe we should ask Alexander Ocasio-Cortez and the socialists in this country why you would need to defend that which you earn, because there are looters and there are moochers and there are social ballast and there are non-productive people who think that they have a fair right to your income or to some fair share of what you earn. And by what right, I would ask. So there are people who on the economic front, they're called socialists, and the more evil of them are, I think, are communists, who take it as their right to appropriate by some unknown means a substantial portion of the wealth or the income that you've earned and allocate it among people who are non-producers. So that's the first answer on the economic front. The second answer on the social front is that there are a bunch of just vulgar, crass, mediocre people who want to obliterate all standards, who want to obliterate all kinds of meaning tests that we use to judge merit and excellence, and just enslave and glut the world with vulgarity, mediocrity. I spoke about, maybe before you came in, Damien, about a movement going on in the K-12 system where they are attempting, and as someone who has taught in the honors department at DePaul, I've taught gifted students for 12 years. I've also taught kids from members of the Ku Klux Klan and inner city kids from East St. Louis in my early career. But as the honors programs in many of the K-12 systems are being abolished on the premise that they discriminate against slow learners, that's one reason why I would think the gifted children ought to be rising up and marching in the street, because what's happening is that a moratorium is being placed on their brains, on their intelligence. War is being declared on their intelligence in the name of those with lesser ability. And while there can be schools for slow learners, I would not be against schools cultivated for slow learners, but you cannot have a situation, for example, where gifted children have their programs abolished and education be demoted, leveled down, to the common denominator of its least competent members, who are the slow learners in that class. So I would say those gifted children, and let's just say you, Damien, are one of those gifted children, would have every right to rise up and defend your brain against the levelers, those who would seek to place a moratorium on your brain in the name of those who are less competent than you are.
And one quick follow-up question. Do you find that that could be taken as an act of aggression when people lay claim or try to give claim to rights, from the things that you produce? Can that be taken as an act of aggression?
It is more than an aggression. It is an aggression, and it is more than that. It's a sort of pseudo murder. It's a nationalization of your brain, under the guise of speaking on behalf of the common good. It is an act of aggression because your mind, as Rand said, it's your basic tool of survival, and your mind is the faculty that produces the income on whatever level you find yourself possessing in the intelligence that you have. On whatever level, it is the faculty that produces the income, the property, whatever means you use to survive. And so any appropriation of that is an act of aggression against you. Yes, most certainly.
Thank you.
All right. We've got just a few more minutes. It's really great to see Miles LePere here in the room. Miles, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, hopefully you guys can hear me all right. I'm in a warehouse. Professor, thank you. It's been an interesting conversation. I missed the first part. I have a bit of a broad question. I appreciated you talking on what's going on in K-12 school systems. Having graduated from Tulane last year, I certainly sense that there's a level of elitism that students get simply from just graduating with a certain degree, without having, actually developed any practical skills at all. And I see that as being a problem, and fundamentally our university system seems broken. This is a big question, but given that you're in the heart of it as a professor, what work has to be done to sort of reverse where we're at now with universities, specifically in college, churning out what I would say students who have this entitlement, when really they haven't developed very many skills at all, depending on what they're studying. I'm sorry if that's broad, but hopefully there's a question somewhere in there.
Well, thanks a lot, Miles. It's just a false sense of elitism where you're sort of stamped with the imprimatur of a pedigree from Harvard or Yale, and that is associated in the minds of other people as you coming with a set of skills. Again, reality is the final arbiter. You go into the workplace, and if you really don't have that skill set that you can leverage in the workplace in a very, very efficacious manner that produces results that are consonant with the goals and the aspirations or the mission statements or whatever it is of the company or the corporation that one is working with, then, you'll be tossed, you'll be part of the dustbin of history. You'll be tossed aside. So that's just one. And I see it happening at my university also. People think that they have a degree from DePaul. I tell them you're being trained to be a floor manager at Walmart. So, don't let it get to your head really, because your degree is actually no better than the degree from Harvard. People at Harvard just have better connections on the ski slopes than you do.
Absolutely.
The second thing I would say, Miles, is that we just probably need to get rid of the Department of Education and abolish public education completely, and abolish any connection between education and the government. One of the reasons that some of these institutions can keep their mythologies afloat is because they are funded partially by the federal government, including Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, all of which are recipients of public funding. I think Hillsdale College is probably one of the only universities in this country that don't refuse this federal funding. So I would call for the complete defunding and complete eradication of the connection between education and the state in this country. Thanks.
Yeah,
thank you.
I think that I might add to that another place to start from a donor class perspective would be to withdraw the sanction of the victim. So many of people who have gone to these universities are funding them out of a sense of, you know, just loyalty, maybe a misplaced admiration for a sure. place that they went to, which in some mm-hmm. cases no longer exists, or to help to help preserve, you know, the legacy for the children. But until those donors wake up and say, you know, I'm really upset with what you're promoting, and I'd like to see some changes.
On that point, sorry to interrupt, on that point, what's concerned me is the abdication of good donors doesn't necessarily mean they won't find other donors. And my concern and what I've seen is the other donors, certain universities, and I'll exclude names, have turned to, have been promoting ideas that, you know, aren't beneficial. And so it's almost like a catch-22. You want to pull back and get out, but at the same time, pulling back and getting out isn't always the best solution. So it's tricky, maybe.
Yeah. No, I agree. That's the perennial tension. Do you try to work for change within the system or without the mm-hmm. system? Obviously, one solution would be to try to fund a particular department or a center within a university. But the other thing I would point to, I did an interview recently with Isaac Morehouse of Praxis, and you can see so many of these young people are now deciding to forgo the entire college process itself and go and pursue apprenticeships. Because in many cases, the college degree just signals, I'm no worse than anybody else that has the same piece of paper. Whereas individuals deciding at a young age to credential themselves and find ways to gain experience and create signaling of that experience to prospective employers is a very exciting place to watch. So. All right. Well, that brings us 1 minute over. This was a really lively conversation. I want to thank Professor Jason Hill, thank our founder, David Kelly. We are going to have a similarly lively week. Next week, we've got three clubhouses scheduled, and we've got two Ask Me Anythings, one on Tuesday with Rob Trusinski, and then with Professor Stephen Hicks on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, Richard Salzman will be taking on why stakeholder capitalism is fascistic. So that should be very interesting. I'll also be having an interview on Wednesday afternoon with Spencer Jacob to talk about GameStop, and that whole struggle between meme stocks and institutions. So thanks, everyone. Thank you, Jason, and hope to see you guys next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.